I don't want anybody to hear, oh, Gabe beat bipolar. People interested like, Gabe Howard, who beat bipolar, is coming on stage. I didn't beat anything. It's a reluctant roommate that I can't get rid of. I think people think of it like pink eye. Oh, I have pink eye and pink eye is dangerous. I need to not rub my eye. I need to put in the drops 4 times a day. But if I do everything right, in a couple of weeks, I will no longer have to think about this ever again. That is the opposite way that you should ever look at bipolar disorder. I think we have a failure from the outset. We keep saying the system is broken. The system is working perfectly. We have instituted a system that frankly does more harm than good. And then we blame the people in the system for the bad outcomes.
Well, everybody, welcome back to Success Rewritten. I'm your host, Emily Lemenza-Washkovic. And today I have with me Gabe Howard. I found Gabe because Gabe is a mental health advocate living with bipolar disorder, like myself. Gabe hosts a couple of podcasts, but the one that I was the most familiar with is Inside Bipolar. It's won a Webby Award before, and he has this incredible book, Mental Illness is an Asshole and Other Observations. I personally devoured this over the last week, so we'll dig into this. And if anyone wants their own signed copy, they can go to Gabe's website, gabehoward.com. But you can buy the book anywhere you get books. You can listen to his podcasts anywhere you listen to podcasts. Gabe, thank you so much for taking the time to come on today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a real treat. I love being on the other side of the microphone. Like it's so much cooler to be a guest, right? Right. Like a host has work. Like you said, you had to do like some research. You had to write questions. You had to put this together. Like I just have to like blab and all of a sudden it goes out in the world. So this is my best day, Emily. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm really grateful to have you because mental health is a big part of my journey, but it's not what we hit on with every single guest. I mean, mental health is something that we all deal with, diagnosis or not, so it threads in there. But to have a guest that is living with bipolar disorder like myself and so openly advocating about it is just really exciting to me. And I can't wait to talk about our different personal experiences and how things feel, but before we get into that, tell us your journey. What was that beginning of navigating mental health or understanding mental illness like for you?
Yeah, so I first want to let the audience know, you know, trying to sum up like your whole life in just a couple of minutes is always really, really difficult. So please understand this is in no way complete. I'm just pulling out like a couple of parts of my story that I think are relevant for your audience. But obviously people are much more complex than just a couple of minute little summary or narrative. But here's what I really feel is the most important thing. I was born this way. So I didn't realize there was a problem. This is how my mind always worked. This is the way that I conceptualize the world. This is the way that everything happened for me, and nobody told me any different. Here we are in 2026, and we're having these huge debates about whether or not we have enough mental health and psychology education. I was born in 1976. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, right? If you think it's bad now, you should have seen how bad it was back then, right? Like, this is the improvement. We are in the better times. So I didn't know that I was sick at all. And I always let people know I thought about suicide as far back as I can remember. And I truly believed that this was just part of the human condition. Now, I want to be clear. Nobody said this to me. Nobody taught me this. This is not some example of something horribly going wrong externally. This is an example of something horribly going wrong internally that nobody had the wherewithal to correct because I never articulated it. And the reason that I never articulated it is very complicated. You know, one, I was raised in a stereotypically blue-collar household. So, you know, men were supposed to be stoic, strong, emotionless, right? Men don't cry. So even though I had a lot of these feelings, I felt that I needed to deal with them. Two, bipolar disorder, even by its very nature, is intermittent, right? Like everybody conceptualizes bipolar disorder as highs and lows, right? You've got your mania and you've got your depression. And people for some reason think that you're one of those. No, those are just the two extremes. You can be everything in between. And Emily, as you well know, I'm sort of preaching to the choir here. One of those extremes is the middle, the stereotypical, the average, right? That's when you do well. That's when you get the job, do well in school, make the connections, make your parents proud. But it also sends a signal to everybody that you can behave, you can achieve, you can do well. So when you become symptomatic, you don't get a lot of people really on your side. All of this coalesced into me being admitted to a psychiatric hospital because, you know, it turns out that I wasn't okay. I needed a lot of help. I needed a lot of resources and I didn't have it. So I woke up one day in a psychiatric ward where I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was put on my first psychiatric medications, released to a step down program, you know, got hooked up with therapies. And I like to say that began my 4-year epic battle against bipolar disorder.
Well, and something that I found so interesting and important in how you tell your story is this constant thought about suicide. Because I'll be honest, when I read that, it confused me at first. I didn't understand really. And then the more I was reading your writing and the way you explained kind of how it felt and the normalcy that you thought it had, it all started to make sense to me. And I'm sure there's so many people who have experienced something like that, whether it's a thought that they have or a feeling that they have, and they haven't wanted to talk about it because they haven't known if it was normal, not normal, or what people might think. Can you just describe a little bit for people what that thought of suicide kind of felt like in terms of the way you say it in the book is so good. I think you say something like, on the bad days, you thought about how you were going to do it. And on the good days, how do you phrase it?
Today is not the day that I'm going to do it. Yeah. That's the part that gets people. They think that suicidality is just, oh, I want to die. I want to die. I want to die. Right. But it's not. That is a part of it. Please don't misunderstand me. That's the most serious part of it. Like that's the part where intervention needs to happen very quickly. But there are so many other things surrounding it that I don't think get enough attention. So first and foremost, I don't think suicide education gets enough attention, but let's move that aside, right? When I thought about it all the time, it was like, obviously on the really bad days, it's like, I could end this all. I'm in control, right? Like I can just end it and be done. And that occupied my mind. And then of course, other things occupy my mind. Like, okay, well, if you're going to do it, how? Like, what's going to happen afterwards? Who's going to get your stuff? Like what method are you going to use? Like all of this is floating around in my head. But you're right, Emily, there are good days. Like, what do you do when you're happy? What do you do on Christmas morning when like Santa fulfilled your wish list and everything is fantastic? Like really? You're thinking about suicide then? No, of course not, right? I'm not thinking about ending my life. I'm not thinking about suicide in the way that people think that you're thinking about suicide. I think today's a good day. I'm not going to do it today. I'm going to give myself a break today. You know what? I'm glad I didn't do it last week. I'm glad I made it here. This was worth waiting on. But what I want the audience to hear and what I want people to really understand is it's not on or off. It's not light or dark. It's this spectrum of nonsense that's all encompassing, and I say nonsense as a layman's terms. In psychology, it's systemic. It's symptomatic, right? It's data. It's okay. How often do you do this? Why do you do it? Do you hype on it? Do you have anxiety? Is it interfering with the activities of daily living? Is it preventing you from making connections? And all of that is going to vary by person, but make no mistake, if you think you're going to die at any given time by your own hand, you're really not all that excited to meet people or to make connections or to strive for anything because, always in my mind, I was, a day, a week, a month from it all being over. So it just became this very here and now kind of thought process. And that has its own damage that then leads to other things. So it's all connected. But yes, even on good days, that was really your question. Even on good days, this latent suicidality caused a problem.
But I'm really glad that you talk about it because I do think there's this huge misunderstanding that when someone loses their life to suicide, it's like this horrible thing happened. They feel like they're at the end of their rope and now it's done. And that is sometimes the circumstance that leads to someone effectively committing suicide. However, it doesn't only become a thought in your mind when something visibly wrong is happening. And that's where I think that huge gap in dialogue is, right? It's this misunderstanding that when you're not thinking about it right now, you're okay. And that's hard, I think. And, I do crisis intervention training through NAMI. I know you have done that as well.
Yep.
One of the
good
most
shout
important
out there. Good,
things.
Love it.
I mean, honestly, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Program,
I got excited. You said NAMI. I got excited. Advocacy. Woo!
I love NAMI too. We need to talk about them. But with the crisis intervention training, something I remember from my first time, like almost 7 years ago, we say to the officers, you know, asking someone if they're thinking about taking their life or thinking about hurting themselves or what the steps are going to be, you're not going to implant that idea in their mind. So you need to ask. You need to be comfortable saying, are you thinking about suicide? And I tell people that all the time, like asking someone that question is not going to implant the idea in their mind. As someone that lives with it, can you maybe just expand or elaborate on that a little bit and the power of actually asking?
Yeah. So one of the hallmarks of suicidality, and again, this is not a one size fits all thing. So I do want to caution your audience. They're like, oh, well, Gabe said that everybody who thinks about suicide does X. Nope, didn't say everyone. I said many people, more often than not, more likely than not. The research shows, right? Just in general, right? So I just want to be very clear that this is not 100%. But one of the hallmarks of suicidality is that nobody will care if I'm dead, right? Let's just call it out. Let's just own it. Like, if I die, nobody will care. Because if you thought that somebody would care, it's a barrier, right? And many people have described, like, what stopped you? I couldn't do it to my grandma. What stopped you? I didn't want my dad to find my body. Like, and so this is this slight acknowledgement that somebody out there gives a crap about you. But suicidality is constantly eating at that. It's constantly eating at that. And if you get to a certain point and it's gone, somebody walking up to you and saying, hey, are you thinking of killing yourself? Is proof positive somebody cares. If they're tiptoeing around it, if they're not being serious, if you can't recognize it. See, that's the thing that people don't understand. They're like, well, I asked him if he was going to kill himself. What did you say exactly? I said, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Yeah, that's not the same thing. Hurting yourself and killing yourself are two unique, separate experiences. Nobody ever says, oh my God, I'm sorry, did your child get hurt? And mean dead. I just, nobody would ever say that. But yet in suicidality, we're like, no. We spoke in code and we don't know why it didn't work. So I say that somewhat flippantly because that's just, you know, my irreverent attitude. But if you thought about it for half a second, I just... why are we so afraid of this? I know that death is scary. And I know that the idea of your loved one being in harm's way is equally scary. And that's why we've got to take this seriously. That is why we have to own it, use real words, not tiptoe around it, not be afraid of it, but fight it head on. I mean, look, I'm analogy city, but could you imagine if firefighters were so afraid of fire that whenever one happened, like they stood way back and just kind of arced the hose at it instead of like breaking down the door and going inside, right? If like all of their stuff was like, oh, you have a heat issue in your house? No, I have a fire. Whoa, we don't say that. We don't want to give the fire power, right? Like it's just, if you think about it, it's nonsense. But I understand that this is from a place of deep misunderstanding and deep concern and deep fear. And all of those are boundaries to people getting the help that they need. And again, I don't want to put too fine of a point on, but the stakes are very high, right?
When we
make this mistake, people lose their lives, and that's permanent. There's no way to backtrack that.
And if someone mentions it, you need to take it seriously, which you hit on over and over and over. And it is urgent. And, you know, I wasn't planning on sharing this, but I can share it without sharing any of this person's details. My husband knows someone who this week shared that they were thinking about that. And luckily, someone raised the flag and said, we need help, you know? And I think at first there was a shock when this person said, I'm thinking about taking my life. And that shock almost led to inaction. I mean, I think there were some people that were like, I heard that. I don't know what to do. And meanwhile, my husband was like, we need to tell someone, you know? And I think that is something that all of us should be aware of. If someone says it out loud, that is a cry for help. You need to take it seriously. And it is urgent. You know, this isn't something that we can circle back to in a day or two. Like, this is a serious thing. And you even hit on it in one of your articles that, you know, sometimes teenagers, as an example, might use or weaponize this towards their parents and they don't mean it. that still, in your mind, is a huge opportunity to treat it seriously and go through the process so that they learn this is not something to joke about. And yeah, I guess I just want to like pause on that together and remind everyone that even if you do hear someone say that and you think it's flippant or a joke or whatever, if you don't address it seriously, you will always wonder and think about that. So take it seriously. And if it was a joke, which is a horrible joke, that person can then learn the gravity of that and that it's not something to be joked about. Is there
one of the things I think about, Emily, with the whole joke thing, and I love doing this because people are like, but aren't you a mental health advocate? Right? Like, I'm not against the joking, right? Like, I know you're like, dude, this is my podcast. How dare you say, like, it is a horrible joke. It's gallows humor, right? You need to have it in the right place. But make no mistake, gallows humor has real benefits to people. I mean, if you're with your buddies and you want to make a gallows humor joke, I mean, Godspeed. Gabe is right there with you. But you need to understand the difference, right? Nobody goes to somebody's funeral and make a murder mystery joke. I mean, could you imagine standing at somebody's funeral after they just lost a loved one and saying, what are you guys doing later tonight? Oh, we're going to a murder mystery. You know we're at a funeral, right? And then, right, let's take it to just a ridiculous place. Let's say that you were at the funeral of a murder victim. Hey, what are you doing tonight? Oh, we're going to murder mystery theater. What the hell? Like, but see, people understand that. Anybody listening would like, well, I would never say that. Like, in fact, maybe if I even knew somebody who was murdered, I'd even stop going to murder mysteries. Right. That's a choice that you can make. With suicidality, we don't seem to understand this. We have this avoid it at all cost mentality. We don't understand when the humor is inappropriate, appropriate. We don't know where the lines are. And I honestly believe this is why. Because a whole bunch of teenagers get angry and they scream, I'm going to kill myself. Their parents don't take them seriously at all because, listen, more often than not, the kid's just venting. The kid's just reacting. But we don't take this opportunity to educate them and say, okay, here's why this is terrible. Here's why this is awful. Here's what you missed, all right? Like, here is where it is a problem. And again, I'm filled with examples because it's my job. But, you know, I remember one time getting like really, really mad and I punched the wall. Right. And you know, my father is like, you can't punch walls. And he's like, you need to punch a pillow. And I was like, wait, what? He's like, yeah, the punching wasn't the problem. It's what you punched. And he's like, he's like, look, if you need to vent, if you want to get a punching bag, if you want to go to the gym, if you want to run it out, if you want to punch a pillow, that's fine. But you don't punch people and you don't punch stuff. Like, this is real consequences. You're paying for that wall. Also, you punch the wall in front of your family. That's scary to them. Like, what's wrong with you? If this is a way that you want to vent, you need to do it safely. And as I grew up, I was like, that was actually like a really powerful moment. Because the punching wasn't the problem. It was what I punched and the loss of control that I had to punch while I... So he taught me accidentally how to manage anger, how to manage expectations, and how to use a coping skill safely. But I think about this a lot because so many people would be like, punching's bad. Punching things are bad. Don't ever punch. Don't ever punch. Don't ever be. And then they take it a step further. Don't ever be angry. Loss of control is bad. Anger is bad. And so suddenly they're like, hey, everything that you just did is wrong and your emotions are invalid. And my dad went another way, which is odd because, you know, he's not a touchy-feely guy. So the fact that he got this one right is actually quite surprising even to me to this day.
Well, I was going to say, from what I know, from what I've read, it's not like he was out here giving mental health advice, but...
No, he's got all kinds of toxic problems when it comes to masculinity, but he nailed a few things. I'll give him credit.
Well, and Gabe, I mean, I think maybe we're stretching this too far, but like, to me, the takeaway of that story is... You don't necessarily have to be a mental health expert to help your child navigate emotions, any of that stuff. And there is a way to teach without shaming, right?
Yes.
Like, your dad wasn't telling you you're horrible, you can't do anything. You know, it was more about why is this route not good to keep doing? And what are some alternative options? Which I think is really helpful for a young kid because... You are trying to figure out how to express yourself, how to let energy out. And so just saying no, 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 that doesn't really do much. If you redirect, that's a lot more helpful. I want to talk about the significant differences in our journey with bipolar disorder. I feel like there's so many things about our experiences that are different. So before I tell you all the differences. Can you start by telling people what bipolar disorder feels like and looks like to you? And I think the way you walk through it, where you talk about symptoms, is really helpful. So anything you want to share just to kick us off? And then I feel like I'll be able to pepper with plenty of things that are maybe different or questions that I have about your experience.
Yeah. So bipolar disorder, it does present slightly differently in everybody. But in general, the things that are the same is sort of the emotional whiplash effect, right? Like pretty much every single person with bipolar disorder is described by their friends and family as moody. And that's a real hallmark, right? But the mania comes with this, like, you know, I'm God, right? The world revolves around me. It's consequence free. Everything that I do is great and nothing bad can ever possibly happen because I am at the center of the universe. And then that goes all the way down to what I call garbage, right? Where everybody hates you and nobody will care if you're dead, including your mom and your grandma and your best friend will just be like, oh, I'm so glad he's dead, right? Right. And they will not care about you and they never cared about you and everybody hates you and you are just a garbage person who is deserving of every bad thing that happens to you. And then, of course, everything in between. For me personally, some of the in-betweens that would sometimes attach to the depression or the mania, you know, because you can get two first, right, was, you know, there'd be periods of grandiosity where I knew everything, right? And then there would be periods of hypersexuality where I was insatiable. All I wanted to do was orgasm over and over and over and over again, and I didn't care how I did it or who I hurt. And that's really problematic because it ruins sex, and sex can be a healthy and good, and in fact, sex is a healthy and good thing among, you know, yourself or consensually with other people. So wrecking it in any way is a real bummer because you're taking, you know, one of the thrills of life and turning it into a disorder or a compulsion. And that's terrible. The next thing is I just had a lot of anxiety. In fact, I do have a co-occurring anxiety disorder, and that manifested in panic attacks and just this general feeling of hopelessness and worthlessness. And then I also had irritability where I would just snap. And then finally, I had psychosis. Psychosis for me was delusions where I thought that there was demons under my bed. I thought that there were demons interacting with the people around me and hurting me in some way. I could never see or hear the demons, but I knew that they were there. And all of these things, they didn't all happen at the same time, right? You know, it was sort of like whack-a-mole. You know, I'd get rid of one and another would pop up. Sometimes they would co-occur. You know, I'd be anxious and hypersexual, or I'd be depressed and anxious, or, you know, I think I knew everything but had no energy to get off the couch, right? That's a very difficult one. And then from a layman's perspective, you know, obviously wanting to die carries its own weight. You're just, because again, as I said earlier in the program, in the podcast, you're not really making future plans if you don't think you're going to be in the future. Well, if you don't make future plans, that's a problem. It's like, I don't need to pay that bill. I'll be dead. Well, then you're not. And then the bill comes due and you're like, what happened? Well, yeah, I spent all the money. Why? Well, because I wasn't supposed to be here. Yeah, but you are here. I know. I quit my job. Why? Well, because, you know, by the time I run out of money, I quit my job on Monday. I got the plan for Friday. Right. But now it's 2 weeks from that plan and you're still here and unemployed. Right. Well, now I'm going to go get a new job. Yeah. You kind of told your boss to take that job and shove it because you didn't care. And now that boss has told the story of the employee that screamed at him to everybody else in your industry. So nobody wants to hire you, which is probably smart. But you know, you're not trying to conserve or build your reputation if you don't think you're going to be around to enjoy the spoils of it. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, how bipolar disorder kind of impacted me and felt to me and manifested for me.
That's such a good description of the range and how things sometimes showed up together. I personally have never experienced bipolar depression, like the deep throes of depression, especially the time frame that they'll put around a diagnosis of like 2 or more weeks. And even how to describe depression, I feel like I've used other people's examples before, but the way that you describe it as nothingness is kind of one of the first things that I felt like actually meant something to me in the descriptors I used to use. Because I would say things like, you know, you feel sad or hopeless, or like you're moving through sludge. Like I understand some of the physical feelings, but that internal emptiness compared to sadness is such a important difference to someone who hasn't felt it before. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Because the words you use to describe it, I feel like opened up an understanding for me.
I think one of the hardest problems with describing depression is you want to describe something. And there's a million examples that I can use for this, but it's like trying to describe death, right? Like, how do you describe death? It's death. It's nothing. You used to be here and now you're not. Somebody used to be here and now they're not, right? There's really, you can't compare it to anything. There's no descriptor. It is nothing, right? It's just like, describe what air looks like. I don't know. I can describe kind of how it feels maybe. No. You got to tell me what it looks like. It doesn't look like anything. You can't see it. And then somebody's like, but you can see it under a microphone microscope. And then, and people try. And the first thing that I want to say is I am so happy that people try because we need to be talking about it. So every single, bad analogy, bad example, completely missed the mark, descriptor that I have heard, I am proud of. Right? Because somebody somewhere is trying to describe how they feel. Many times I think they've missed the mark and they got it wrong, but who cares? Right? It's like when people sing their favorite song and they can't sing, but they look so happy, right? They're just like, they got their hand up, they're dancing, like they are completely out of tune and missing half the words, but the joy on their face carries the moment. So please, if you are listening to this, keep describing depression in whatever way feels good for you and don't psych yourself out that it's a bad example. But for me, it's nothing. You don't have the energy to move. You can't form thoughts. You don't care what happens to you. An example that I started using a long, long time ago is pretend that you're walking down the street, right? You're just walking down the street, minding your own business, and somebody throws a tennis ball at you, right? You do not see them coming. You're not expecting anything. As soon as you see that tennis ball coming your way, you instinctively move out of the way. You don't know what's coming. You don't know who threw it. You don't know why they threw it. You don't know anything, but you instinctively protect yourself by moving out of the way of the tennis ball. Our body's innate desire to protect ourselves is stronger than why did they throw it? Who threw it? What did they throw? Will it even hurt if it hits me? I mean, a tennis ball is not nothing. In fact, it was a 3-year-old who threw it. So this, who cares? Why did I even know? Our body's desire to protect itself is greater than the body's desire to know why it's protecting itself. It senses fear, it reacts. Depression overrules all of that. Depression is like, whatever. I don't know. I don't care. I just, and it's worse than that because, people are always like, I'm walking through sludge, right? But you're walking. Like, where'd you get the energy for that? Right? Like, and I just point that out to people because I want people to understand. And again, we can do this all day. And that's why I opened up with this first hour, because I don't want anybody who's like, well, I describe it as walking through sludge. Good. You should keep doing
yes.
it. It's not bad.
Right.
But the downside and the incompleteness of that is that what people hear is, okay, but you can walk through sludge, right? So all these depressed people are just lazy. They're not trying hard enough. That walking through sludge is harder, but you could if you wanted to. And then they go back to all their depressed friends and be like, hey, I know you're walking through sludge and that kind of sucks, but man up and walk through the sludge. It's like, no, you just... First off, that person was describing their experience, right? Depression is not one size fits all. You can be a little depressed, a lot depressed, suicidal depressed, can't get out of bed depressed, right? Like depression is also a spectrum, right? I mean, everything's a spectrum. That's 100% of things are a spectrum. We've got rich people, super rich, uber rich, and ridiculously rich. And then there's levels above that. So rich doesn't even have one size fits all. And we all recognize that. But yet for some reason, we think that every single depressed person is exactly the same. And it's often darkness and abyss and sludge. And those aren't terrible examples. They're just incomplete and they allow for a lot of misunderstanding. So I wanted to add more to the universe. But make no mistake, if you're describing it as sludge, that may be accurate for you. In which case, keep doing it and, mumble under your breath that I'm an asshole because I'm okay with that.
But I think that's something that really stands out in your work. You have opinions on things. You try to let people know why you're coming from this point of view, but you're also not trying to stop anyone from sharing what it's like for them. And I think that is a huge part of the mental health world that still has a really far way to go. Telling someone that the way they describe something like is or isn't right is not like that's not really helping anyone. But language is definitely one of those things where the more we know about different people's perspective on language, language, the more confident we feel using it. And I think that the way you show up and educate, but then leave that space for other people's experience is huge. I mean, even the terminology of I am bipolar or I have bipolar disorder. Like when I was reading your chapters, and granted, a lot of these articles are from a while ago. And so it's very helpful that you have them dated and referenced. But I was thinking to myself, I'm like, huh, do I have like a completely different opinion? And then by the end of the chapter, I was like, oh, Gabe isn't actually telling you what is right or wrong. He's saying, this is how I identify. And so much of it was centered around your POV. So like, if someone else wants to say they're living with bipolar or have bipolar, that's kind of on them, is how you were showing up to the dialogue. But you were also informing people about why someone might feel offended by certain terminology. And I think sometimes in advocacy, we miss that opportunity. Like we speak to our experience and we want them to understand our experience. And it kind of deludes the fact that that is our experience on a spectrum. What do you think about that in terms of like advocacy now? Because you've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, I'm always so fascinated about the language debate, right? So what you're describing is person-first language. And the first thing that I want to say is I have zero problem with person-first language, except for the fact that person-first language thinks that it's correct and that every other form of expression is wrong. That's where they lose me. If they're like, hey, if you say it this way, it generates this thought, that I think that's a fantastic discussion point. And I also want to be clear, I think that person-first language has certain areas where it belongs. If you own a hospital, an emergency room, and you're like, look, I want all of my practitioners to be using person-first language, I think that's a good idea, right? So I want to be clear. I feel this way about all areas of life, right? I used to work for a restaurant and we didn't call the towels rags. Look, they were all rags, but rag has like a connotation, right? If you're in your kitchen at home and you say, hand me a rag, nobody thinks a thing of it. If you're in a restaurant and somebody says, throw me a rag, you're like, ooh, dirty. You're wiping, ooh, that's yuck. So they call them towels, right? So if there was some sort of initiative that said, look, if you call a rag in your house, you're a bad person and you're discriminating against somebody and you don't understand that you're a whole person, I'd be like, that's nonsense. But if you want to make it a priority in your restaurant to call them towels so that the customers have a good experience, I also think that's valid. And that's the problem that I have with these initiatives. Listen, Emily, as sure as we are sitting here, nobody in the history of ever has lied awake at night and wondered if they're having a mental health crisis. They wonder if they're going crazy. They wonder if they're going effing insane. They're crying, they're rocking. They're not using the correct language. And what worries me about that is one of the hallmarks of the mental health industry and of mental health advocacy was meet people where they are. And then we suddenly tried to tell them how to speak. Are we meeting them where they are, or are we telling them how to speak? And then for reasons I don't understand, even though every therapist I've ever had has said, Gabe, you suffer from black and white thinking, and black and white thinking is bad. You can't have black and white thinking. Black and white thinking is bad. Suddenly the mental health industry had black and white thinking that this is the only way that you can ever speak. And I'm just like, you're not even modeling behavior anymore. Again, I am fascinated as a mental health advocate that when I say I'm married, nobody says a word. When I say I'm a podcaster, nobody says a word. When I say I'm hungry, nobody says a word. But when I say I'm bipolar, they're like, you poor little butterfly, you're so much more. You're a full person, right? Your disease doesn't define you. Like, I never said it did. I didn't say I'm just bipolar. You added that. And the last thing that I always want to say is we have taught a whole group of sick, desperate, vulnerable, struggling people who are new to the industry, or I'm sorry, new to getting care, that are new to getting help, that if somebody calls you bipolar, they're insulting you. When more often than not, they're just using language. And language is inherently messy. And we see this play out. One time when I was a kid, here's another dad story. One time when I was a kid, I did something and I said, I'm bad. And my dad said, you're not a bad kid. And I was like, no, like Michael Jackson. And he's like, huh? And I'm like, you know, I'm bad, right? The album was all the way. He's like, oh, it means good? I was like, yeah. He's like, then why didn't you say I'm good? Well, because no, it means like I'm bad. And he's just like, looking, he's like, but you're not a bad. I'm like, no, it means good. He's like, so bad means good? What the hell are you talking about? Right? But I explained it to him. I showed him the album I got, and he's like, okay, whatever. Right. And then he moved on. But imagine if he would have said no, Saying right. I'm bad doesn't mean that you're cool. It doesn't mean that you're awesome. It means that you're insulting yourself and that you're less than. And he would have just like badgered me with that over and over and over again so that every time I heard Michael Jackson's bad, I had negative feelings, right? And every time somebody walked up to me and said, oh my God, Gabe, that was awesome. You're so bad. I got offended. All of those compliments would have dissipated immediately because my father would have instilled in me that the people giving me the compliment were actually insulting me. And that's how this whole thing ends. So often people are like, oh, Emily, you're bipolar. They're trying to connect with you. They're trying to talk right. to you. They're trying to have honest, robust conversations. They're trying to understand your journey. But we have a whole industry that has trained you to say, I am not. I am more than just. And now you're attacking them. And this person's like, I ain't talking to you. You're nuts. And frankly, I mean, aren't you? They asked you an honest question. And their context was empathetic. They were kind. They were open to learning. And you yelled at them. And now they don't want to talk to you anymore. And for some reason, even though the mental health industry has been told this over and over and over again, number one, and two, there are zero studies to back up anything that they're saying about this language initiative, they continue to promote it as fact. And that is damaging and dangerous, and I wish they'd stop it. Because I thought that science mattered. I thought that facts mattered. But apparently in some carve-outs, and I'm calling them all out equally, so please don't think I'm picking on just one. We're all guilty of it, even myself sometimes, right? I think we need to take a 35,000-foot view. We need to start policing context, and we need to understand that not every single person who says I'm bipolar thinks they're just bipolar, and not every single person who says are you bipolar is attacking you. And I think that's a much healthier way, a much more mentally healthy way, I might add, of approaching the world.
I agree, and I'm really glad that you shared that perspective, because it was only like 2 weeks ago or so that I was sharing a post about language, and I was just talking about how I identify myself, you know, and I have that, you know, thought, feeling. I think it's good for other people to be aware of it, but I would never totally sidetrack an interaction by an assumption that someone meant something bad by not saying I'm living with bipolar. And so you leaning into that and also explaining the negative impact that that approach can have, I think is really important, because there's something different from talking about language and how you perceive it and, you know, all of that compared to shutting down the conversation and labeling someone as that's the wrong way or a hurtful. And it just really goes against everything we try to do as advocates, which is talk about it more, make it more normalized, let people ask questions. And so I'm really glad that I read your perspective and then also we got to talk about it live, because it is important, especially in advocacy, to be willing to listen to other points of view and remember that yours is an experience, but it's really helpful to hear from other people's perspective on what they do or don't find offensive, harmful, helpful, because it just opens all of our minds a little bit, I think.
Absolutely. And I want to be very clear. If somebody comes up to me and says, Gabe, don't say that I'm bipolar. Please say that I'm a person living with bipolar disorder. I will immediately do it, right?
Of course.
They have asked me to. My stance isn't that it's good or bad. My stance is that it's an option. My stance that it has some benefits, some drawbacks, just like so many things, right? I mean, just like, listen, let's take the wellness industry, right? If you follow a wellness influencer that tells you that there are bad foods, yeah, that's too far the other way. But if you follow a wellness influencer who's like, oh, eat all the donuts you want, it's fine. Nope, that's not okay either, right? We need moderation. You know, is the occasional donut going to hurt you? No. Is eating nothing but donuts going to hurt you? Yes. We need to find the middle ground, people. And I think we need this, you know, quote unquote, you know, moderation is key mentality in our mental health. Because listen, it's difficult. And it would be ludicrous to think that people are going to agree with me. Like 100% of the people are going to agree with me. I think that a lot of people agree with some of what I say. I would think there's a decent amount of people who agree with most of what I say. But no matter who you are, I mean, even my most ardent fan, I just is like, you know, this is wrong, Gabe. I don't agree with this at all. I'm like, yeah, but that is what happened to me. And that is how I feel about it. And they're like, you know what? I can live with that. And this allows us to get along. It allows us to grow. And I said a long, long time ago, you know, on a podcast, I said, I'm not trying to make fans. I'm trying to make critical thinkers. Because one of the greatest gifts that I ever got was the ability to think for myself. That's what I fought for. That's what I strived for. I wanted to be the captain of my own ship, right? I didn't want other people telling me what to do. I wanted to control it. And that meant I had to be allowed to make mistakes. It means that I had to think through those mistakes. It had to mean I had to make corrections. I had to talk to the people I wanted and not talk to the people I didn't. I had to learn to set boundaries and guardrails. And yeah, there was a lot of growing pains along the way. And I was really, really fortunate with my friends and my family and the social workers, therapists, PhDs, doctors, and the support team and the care team that I got, that they allowed me that. But make no mistake, not everybody gets the Gabe treatment. You said at the beginning you were lucky, and it comes down to luck. And I don't want it to come down to luck. I think it's ludicrous that it comes down to luck. We have way too much knowledge, way too many resources, way too much science, way too much data. The fact that this is luck is actually deeply, deeply, deeply disturbing. We talk about systemic failures. I think we have a failure from the outset, which is the way that we conceptualize this, look at it, and the way that we treat the people in the system is flawed from jump. I think everything is broken from day one. But here's the thing, and I swear I'm going to put the soapbox away. The system, unfortunately, is not broken. The system was designed to do this. We keep saying the system is broken as if it's a mistake or a flaw, or it's unexpected. No, the system is working perfectly. There is nothing broken about it. There is nothing flawed about it. We have instituted a system that frankly does more harm than good, and we're all just okay with it. And then we blame the people in the system for the bad outcomes. So we don't have to hold the people who work in the system or who created the system or who are upholding the system accountable. Here's the reality, right? In the light most favorable to everybody, and to be as fair as I can, everybody involved in the system is responsible for its failure. So why we're just blaming patients is beyond me. Why aren't we blaming the doctors? Why aren't we blaming the politicians? Why aren't we blaming the hospitals? The very fact that a system can fail and we decided that it's the participants' fault and not the architects is deeply disturbing. But I'm going to take a 35,000 foot view and ask why we just can't share the responsibility of the system being broken. But most people hearing this is like, well, but you got to admit, I mean, people aren't med compliant. People don't show up. People are lazy. Homeless people, they're aggressive. I mean, it's probably their fault. I mean, but the doctors are trying their best. I mean, everybody's working the hardest they can, right? I hear all of this. It's like, wow. You are willing to tell a whole bunch of people who are sleeping indoors with fed bellies and comfy beds that they are blameless. And you are willing to take a whole bunch of sick people and telling them that they have the authority to change it and that it's their fault it's broken. And that is American advocacy all wrapped up in a nice little bow, and that has to change rapidly.
Yeah. I mean, we have like no time left. I feel like you and I could talk for forever, but I do kind of want to put a bow on this. Right? Like, no, I know. I mean, I guess the thing that I want to say about that, and then I have something that I want you to close with, but like, my entire experience is steeped in privilege. And I believe that my day-to-day life, my health is all steeped in privilege. Like, I was born genetically with bipolar disorder. I believe that. But I also think the way that it shows up in my day-to-day life now is less intrusive on certain levels because of the privileges of my life. Like, I just, and unhoused people are like so near and dear to me because I feel like anyone can be one step away from that if you don't have support. And I just have a huge, 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 huge family. And so I feel like I have all these little like net pieces under me, you know? And you're right that the system is really messed up. And if you're navigating through it without feeling that, it's almost like, well, ugh. You know, And if you actually look at the people that are trying to get help and not, that's when it quickly becomes clear all of the problems. I mean, they're rampant at every level of the process. Okay, to close out, you often say that you spend more time living your life than managing your bipolar disorder. I feel like that is true for me too, and I feel like that's a great goal for people. Can you just give some closing advice on maybe how you got there and what that looks like? Like, how do you show up for yourself right now in a way that keeps you feeling balanced?
So the first thing I want to say is, like social media, we're starting to understand that social media is curated, right? We put our best moments out there and we hide our worst moments. And even when we put our worst moments out there, we flourish them up to make it seem like we learned a lesson when actually we're just pissy. Or we put our worst moments out there, but then we deny it context. You know, we're just like, well, they broke up with me and they were horrible. And we leave out the part where we cheated, right? Like, so people are starting to understand that, you know, social media is not, you know, a perfect narrative structure of reality. All this to say, you know, listening to my podcast, reading my book, following me is not narrative structures my reality. I try to be more vulnerable. I try to give the context. I try to, but you know, not everything can be conceptualized into writing. So I don't want anybody to hear, oh, Gabe beat bipolar. I never like people interested, like, Gabe Howard, who beat bipolar, is coming on stage. And I'm like, I got to walk that back because I didn't beat anything. It's a reluctant roommate that I can't get rid of. That said, I have figured out how to, like, you know, make some structures that make the roommate more tolerable, right? Like, I gave up the fact that, you know, bipolar disorder was ever going to clean up the kitchen. So we agreed that he would only cook on Tuesday and we hired a cleaning person to come on Wednesday, right? Like we've made some compromises, right? But that does mean that Tuesday night, I'm going to have to tolerate a crappy kitchen. But that's one day and it's not unexpected. I know that Tuesdays is going to happen. So maybe I just avoid the area, right? Maybe I go out to dinner that night. I just, like, walk in the door, you know, with my blinders on, like a horse racing, right? And it's all kinds of stuff like that. That is an example of a coping skill. And two, I recognize that, you know, to your thing, I spend more of my life living my life than I do managing bipolar disorder. Notice I didn't say I spend my life living my life, right? There's some part of my life that has to be dedicated to managing this illness. And I think that many people conceptualize bipolar disorder and serious mental illness incorrectly. They think that it is something that they will eventually get over, like it will go away, like it will be done. I think people, you know, think of it like pink eye. They're like, oh, I have pink eye and pink eye is dangerous. I need to take pink eye seriously. I need to go to the doctor. I need to stay away from people so I don't spread it. I need to not rub my eye. I need to put in the drops 4 times a day. But if I do everything right, in a couple of weeks, I will no longer have to think about this ever again. That is the opposite way that you should ever look at bipolar disorder. You should look at bipolar disorder as, okay, I need to think about this for a little bit every day or at least every other day. I need to make sure that I continue to put the drops in for the rest of my life. And if I do all the right things, I will spend very little time on bipolar disorder. But very little time is not no time. And I need to take my meds as prescribed. I need to manage my moods. I need to pay attention to lifestyle choices like sleep, exercise, health, and eating right. I need to be aware of when my mood drops to a level where I need to ask for help, whether it's simple help, like, you know, from my spouse or my friends or my family, or whether it's medical help, like I need to call up the doctor and be like, look, I can't wait to my next appointment. I need to see you right now. I need to be monitoring that and in control of it. I need to make sure that I'm honest with my doctors. I need to make sure that I'm prepared for my doctor. You know, so many people, it's like, hey, what are you going to talk about with your doctor? I don't know. You're not keeping a list. You don't have like a top three. You get 12 minutes to talk to your doctor. You can't be fumbling around, man. Like, go. Oh, you know, but that's what I mean by I'm spending time on it. Yes. And then finally, I have to be aware when somebody says, hey, Gabe, are you okay? All right. Is that the generic, hey, Gabe, are you okay? Because everybody, you know, Gabe, are you okay? Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Right. And that's cool, right? That's a social convention. We're all good at it. And 99% of the time, that's good enough. But what if they're asking because they see something I didn't? So I need to know when to say, hey, why are you asking? Like, what are you noticing? And of course, I also need to train the people around me to not say, hey, Gabe, are you okay? When they mean, hey, are you struggling? Are you, because we got to use the right words. If my wife sits me down and looks me dead in the eyes and say, hey, man, you all right? Like, I've noticed some weirdness. Like, are you struggling? Are you suffering? Can I do anything? Like, I know she's not kidding, right? First off, she didn't ask it casually. She sat me down and looked me in the eyes. So that's like, you know, every man is like, no, that's serious, man. She looked you in the eyes. Like, you know, something's going on, man. If she didn't send you a text or like say it in the car, like that's like, but I think every spouse recognizes that if somebody is intentional about asking, you know, they're not just casually asking, that maybe give it some more weight. But we need to train ourselves and our support system. So all of this takes time, is my point. Practicing the coping skills, learning the coping skills. So I wish I had the magic bullet for you. But if I did, I'd also have dump trucks of money, which I do not have.
Because we don't need it. We need to figure out how to make it manageable. And I think what you said about it's not going away, like, that's one of the most important things I want to tell people too. I take medication every day. I plan to take it every day for the rest of my life. And I'm glad the one I'm on right now really works. So
yeah. Amen.
Whatever you're going through, it's okay. And the end goal is not to be rid of it, but to understand how to show up for yourself and have the people around you show up for you.
It's okay. Management, right? It's management. I think we need to look at long-term management. Emily, this has been absolutely
wonderful.
We could do this all day.
I'm
all on board with all day, but you know, unfortunately, man, we just don't have all
day. But you know
what?
That's why people can check out your stuff. They heard a little bit, now they can go find more. So mental illness is an asshole and other observations. Go buy it. But most importantly, GabeHoward.com. You can see all of his work, all of his podcasts. And in the show notes, we're going to drop everything. I'm going to have to put that story about my tattoo and your tattoo somewhere else.
Where's our tattoos? Hang on.
I know. Mine's a hard one to see, like, on this side of the camera.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to, like, aim mine at the camera. Like, but there it is. It's right there.
There we are.
Yay!
Gabe, thank you. Go do the rest of the amazing things you have going on today. We appreciate you.